4.3 Sound FM CKMS Radio Waterloo. I was just trying to get my Audacity recording up here. And right now I have a special guest with us here. His name is Bob Jonkman. And Bob, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Glad to be here, Arlene. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Now, I was looking at the Fair Vote Canada stuff here. And one of the questions I wanted to ask here is, when was Fair Vote Canada established?
Fair Vote Canada has been around for close to 15 years at this point. Fair Vote Waterloo, the local chapter, started exactly 10 years ago. April 2006 was their first inaugural meeting.
Oh, great, great. That's a great organization. And how can people get involved with Fair Vote Canada?
The easiest thing to do is to send an email to one of us and find out, or look at the website, fairvotewrc.ca, and find out what events are going on. Show up at an event, say that you're interested in volunteering or helping out, or just interested in learning more about proportional representation, or possibly telling us what do you think of electoral reform and proportional representation. So tonight, actually, this is Tuesday, we're having a series of community dialogues at the Queen Street Commons Cafe. And I'm sure we'll get into this in a bit more detail, but there's this huge electoral reform initiative taken by the government. They're looking for input from citizens, and Fair Vote Waterloo is helping do that by setting up these community dialogues where we're getting input from ordinary citizens, grassroots movement, to provide input to the Special Committee on Electoral Reform. So that's happening tonight, Queen Street Commons at 6:30 p.m.
Absolutely, that is absolutely great. In fact, I have put a notice on my show because now I have since now they've given me the login to put on my shows and everything on soundfm.ca. Now I also wrote up here on August 17th that Fair Vote Canada hosts electoral reform dialogue for people to see. So what I've done here is I have put this up here. So
lovely.
And I'm just gonna go and quickly read this off before I ask additional questions because I just want people to know what exactly is going on. So tonight they have a dialogue at Queen Street's Common Cafe at August 30th at 6:30. They also have one on September 13th at 6:30, September 20th at 6:30. September 27th at 6:30 and October 4th at 6:30. Now, if anyone has any questions on how they want to get involved, they can email Sharon Somerville at sharonsomerville@gmail.com.
Yeah, in fact, we've actually got a new address. Recently, one of our members has set up a series of addresses. So we have info@fairvotewrc.ca. So there's a nice generic address. If Sharon isn't available, then the address info@fairvotewrc.ca is a nice generic address to get more information. Turns out that email at the moment goes to the two co-chairs. I am the co-chair of Fair Vote Waterloo along with Sharon Somerville. So right now the two of us will be recipients of that email. But the info@fairvotewrc.ca address is expected to be around for a good long time.
Oh, that's great. In fact, I'm just going to repeat this again. So that's info@fairvotewrc.ca.
Yeah.
And I've just written that down. I'm going to make sure to update that that article too as well. Now, also I want to confirm here, just to continue on, Fair Vote Canada also has events being held at Kitchener Public Library, which is the central branch, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. on Thursday, September 8, 2016. Registration is required. May I ask what will be held at that location as well as the Elmira, New Hamburg, and Air branch?
Yeah, they all look to be somewhat similar. In the spring, Fair Vote Waterloo Region Chapter put together a presentation on the different electoral systems, but concentrating largely on proportional representation. The mandate for Fair Vote and Fair Vote Waterloo is definitely to promote proportional representation. So we're after electoral reform, but specifically to get some sort of proportional system in place. But it seemed that there was a lot of scattered information, both on the Fair Vote Canada website, on some of the party websites, Green Party website, NDP website, with various bits of information, all of it very good, but none of it particularly complete from what we could tell. So we set up a special committee in the spring and developed a presentation, a slideshow that we're actually going to be presenting at the various libraries. So Kitchener Public Library on September the 8th is the first one. Byron Weber-Becker will be presenting that. He's the main author for the presentation, so you actually get to hear him do the presentation that he was very involved with in setting up.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's great as well. I mean, it's good to be involved in this stuff because when it comes to fair vote, like for me personally, when I went to the polls the one time, you looking for a plug?
I'll find one.
Here, there's one right here.
The radio station. It runs on electricity.
Or,
that's wonderful.
Yeah. Or there's one just right in front of you.
You're good, Aline. Thank you.
No problem. Yeah, I was just going to say as well that when I mean, and I'm not going to sound arrogant here. I don't want to toot my own horn here as well. But I was going to say that when they did have the provincial election in 2007, I was living in Sarnia, Ontario at the time. I was a college student. First time I was able to vote in any provincial election. And I voted yes to the proportional representation. And the one thing I learned... but I know this is not entirely true that I got from the teacher, I will say. I mean, not true, but not entirely accurate, I should say. He did tell us that when it comes to the states, that one of their vote is they vote one for their MP, or not their MP, but their state representative, whatever they have down there, and one they vote for the president. Is that true about the states?
I'm not very familiar with the intricacies of how elections work in the United States. I know that's... The overall system is a winner-take-all system.
It still is.
Yeah, they have no proportionality in, I think, their state legislatures, and certainly not in their federal Congress or Senate. So the United States is actually one of the very few large Western democracies that does not use proportional representation, Canada being another one, the United Kingdom is one, and Australia uses... an alternative vote system, a winner-take-all system for their main house, and their Senate is actually elected proportionally. So they're sort of half winner-take-all. So that makes these countries unusual worldwide, in that most countries that are in the top 80 of the OECD or best on the United Nations Human Development Index, by any measure of those countries, most of them are all... proportional, or all elect their representatives by proportional representation. So United States is unusual, Canada, United Kingdom, and half of the legislature in Australia.
Well, that's good. Well, that's good clarification. In fact, I was just going to say that, you know, because I, because of part of that misinformation I got by my high school teacher at one point, I decided to say yes for change to proportional representation, not even fully understanding what was going on at that time. But I really liked the idea of it because it represents, because I did read it a little bit in my civics class that, you know, countries like, I think New Zealand uses proportional representation, so I was able to understand it maybe a tiny bit. But because of a small bracket of understanding, I actually do support the idea.
Good. Yeah, New Zealand is an excellent case. Canadians who are in favor of proportional representation love what New Zealand did. They switched to proportional representation around 1996, about 10 or 11 years before Ontario held their referendum. But before they actually switched, they had a number of referenda for the population to decide on what they wanted. So once the idea had been instilled into the population for New Zealand, and it had a lot of support from the mainstream media, something that we don't see in Canada. It seems that the mainstream media is largely entrenched in the current system and wants to keep things the way they are. Now, that's fine for them, but unfortunately it means that proportional representation in Canada is not getting equal press time. That wasn't the case in New Zealand. New Zealand had a lot of support from the mainstream media and considerable support from their parliamentary system there as well. So they set up a referendum question, a two-part referendum question. The first part was, do you want to keep the electoral system that we have now? Their current system at the time then was first past the post. And so that was a yes-no question. And then the second part of the question was, if you chose that you wanted to change, which of these three or four or five systems do you want to switch to? Multi-member proportional, or a single transferable vote, or possibly some other systems? I don't know the exact wording of the question, but it was a well-worded question that gave people more than just a binary choice, more than just a choice of yes or no. So that question was answered, and the outcome of that question was in favor of multi-member proportionals. I'll explain what those different systems are as the show progresses. Then the parliament went back for at least a year of study on this question. How can we best set up a multi-member proportional system? How can we best address the needs of what the people who responded to the referendum wanted? That took over a year. Then they held another referendum, a second referendum, which essentially said that since you've chosen MMP, do you really want to switch from first past the post to MMP? And the answer to that was mostly yes. A majority of people voted for yes. So a lot of education happened before that, and there were well-worded questions, and there was support from the media in New Zealand. In 1996, you know, another year later, they finally enacted the legislation to implement mixed-member proportional in New Zealand. Then, about 10, 12, 15 years passed, and about 3 or 4 years ago, they held a third referendum asking, now that you've seen how mixed-member proportional works, do you want to keep mixed-member proportional? And the answer to that question was yes. People were very, very satisfied with the proportional system, the mixed-member proportional system that they'd chosen 15 years earlier. So the whole process for electoral reform in New Zealand took 20 years to enact. Canada is trying to get it done in, you know, a little bit over a year. The promise was made by the Liberal Party during the election campaign in October that they would switch away from first past the post. The committee, the Special Committee for Electoral Reform, didn't get struck until, I believe, April or possibly May. They've got 6 months to get consultations from the public, submissions to the website, listening to expert testimony, which is actually going on right now. The committee is in session right now, and you can see that on CPAC. Not that I want anybody to switch away from Sound FM. But those consultations are going on. People can make written submissions. They can make submissions online. They can make submissions at the community dialogues that we're putting on at the Community Commons tonight. But that all has to be in place by October the 7th, which is why our community dialogues go right until the first week of October. Then the committee will deliberate until the beginning of September, and in September they'll make a proposal to Parliament, and Parliament will either pass a bill to enact what the committee has proposed, or they'll take several ideas under consideration. I'm not entirely sure what the outcome of the deliberations for the special committee will be. So we're trying to get it all done in about 9 months' time, whereas it took New Zealand 20 years to properly educate people and implement proportional representation.
It took 20 years for New Zealand to put it all through?
To put it all through and to verify it and to get people's approval and to test the system. And so from about 1994, when they were first proposing it, a referendum in 1994, a referendum in 1995, implementing it in 1996, going through several election cycles, and then in about 2012, 2014 maybe, they had a third referendum that ratified the decision by the people. So it took a long time for New Zealand, but New Zealand got it right. New Zealand did a very good job in educating the voters on what the different systems were, what the alternatives were, and what choices could be made in the referendum. They also had very good referendum questions, and they had support from the media.
So I guess in that case here, even if it, I hope it doesn't take Canada 20 years. That would be a very long time.
Be a very long time. But there are a lot of people who are very concerned that changing the electoral system in Canada is a very fundamental issue. And many people want more input than what the committee is giving them. Specifically, a lot of people want a referendum in Canada. Now, Canada is slightly different from New Zealand in that Canada has a Referendum Act that was put in place in 1992 or so, shortly after the constitutional referendum for Quebec separation. The Referendum Act says that a referendum can only be called for a constitutional issue, yet electoral systems don't fall under the Constitution. It's not a constitutional issue. The only constitutional issue that affects elections in Canada is the number of seats that are allocated to the different provinces. So as long as any new electoral system doesn't change the number of seats in a particular province, electoral systems, electoral reform in Canada is not a constitutional issue. And so the Referendum Act says, no, referendums don't apply to these issues. And in fact, we've seen this time and time again. Just a few years ago, the Harper government, the Conservative government in 2014 or 2013, passed the Fair Elections Act, which fundamentally changed how people could go to the polling booths and vote. It took away the right for people to show up at a polling booth and have their neighbor vouch for their identity. Now people need to have an established government issue ID, such as a passport or a driver's license or some other identification. That was a fundamental change in how people were allowed to vote. A lot of people were disenfranchised. Their vote was taken away from them because some of the marginalized communities don't have this ID. They have no cars. They don't have driver's licenses. They don't travel internationally, so they don't have passports. And now that their neighbors can't vouch for their identity, it means that they lost the ability to vote in an election. That's a fundamental change, and there was no thought even of having a referendum on that particular question. In fact, because the Conservatives at the time had a majority in their parliament, you know, with 39% of the vote, they had that majority in parliament, so they ran through this legislation, stopped discussion on the issue. They instituted cloture, I think, so that debate on the issue was actually cut off, and not all members of parliament had a chance to voice their views on this. But even if they had, the fact that the Conservatives had a majority of the seats, some 54% of the seats in parliament at the time, were able to push through this legislation, even if every other parliamentarian from the other parties had voted against this issue, there were insufficient number of seats from the other parties to be able to counteract this. So Canada has a long history, actually, of enacting electoral reform legislation without ever taking it to a referendum. So giving women the vote, for example, giving Aboriginals the vote, changing the voting system so that there are write-in votes for people who live abroad. And in the Fair Elections Act, denying people who have been living abroad from casting a vote in electoral in federal elections. These are fundamental electoral reform issues that have never been taken to even a parliamentary committee, let alone a referendum.
Oh, I totally agree with that, because tell you the truth is, the Referendum Act in 1992 that was passed, and I believe that was passed by the Mulroney government at the time.
It would have been right.
See, that should have never been passed in the first place, because, you know, referendums should be for pretty much anything. You know, if you want a free and democratic country and society, having a Referendum Act saying only to have it for constitutional issues, that disenfranchises the rights of all Canadians.
What you're suggesting is something called participatory democracy.
Yes.
Which is a great system. Switzerland has something like that. Switzerland puts all manner of legislation and issues of all sorts to referenda. The trouble is that a lot of these issues have subtle ramifications. They have subtle issues that go around them. Issues that the average voter may not be fully aware of. So this is why we in Canada have a representative democracy. We elect representatives who can become experts in the field of legislation and understanding at a very deep level the legislation that needs to be passed. So in this particular case for electoral reform, the issue of electoral reform, you know, what are the different voting systems? How are Canadians disadvantaged by the current voting systems? What should be proposed in place? These are things that are best answered by experts. And so the Special Committee for Electoral Reform right now is getting that information from electoral experts, academics and other people who have written about electoral reform. And so experts, or the information provided by experts, will be given to the parliamentarians so that they can make an informed decision. It's a level of education that just isn't available to the average citizen, because you and I, we have to dig ditches for a living and don't have time to immerse ourselves entirely in electoral reform. Now, certainly, there's a few people, largely members of organizations like Fair Vote or other electoral reform advocacy groups, that do immerse themselves in that. But that's a very small segment of the population that really understands the electoral reform issue well enough to be able to make that level of decision. That's why we elect parliamentarians. That's why we elect members of the parliament, to make informed, difficult decisions for us.
Oh, and I agree. In fact, I was just going to say as well that when it comes to the elections and all of that information, what I wanted to say is that, you know, because of proportional representation, which is a good idea, it's absolutely a good idea, because look at Ontario, look at the province of Ontario, and look at our government. We've had, with all the corruption the Ontario government has faced with all the scandals, especially with Hydro One, Orange, and other scandals, would this have not happened if Ontario already established a PR system? And the same thing with the Senate scandal and other scandals that have happened under Harper's watch?
Calling legislative issues that are passed legally, calling them scandals, is a little strong. While I am certainly not in favor of much of the legislation that has passed, you know, both provincially and federally, can't really call it a scandal because it is working the way that the system is designed to work. Now, I'm the first one to say that the way the system is designed to work is a broken system. You know, the bulk of the population's wishes are not reflected in the composition of Parliament or in the composition of the provincial legislature, for example. So things get passed, things like providing subsidies to the gas plants and then canceling the gas plants or selling off hydro. These are issues that the Liberals are passing provincially in the legislature with a majority of the seats that they hold in the legislature, but it does not reflect the will of the majority of the voters in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where that disconnect exists, that the bulk of the people who did not vote for the Liberals and
I didn't either.
Yeah, exactly. So there are more people who did not vote Liberal provincially than people who did vote for the Liberals. So we're actually having a small fraction of the population electing members to the legislature, and that legislation that they wanted to pass, such as selling off hydro, is what gets passed in Parliament. It's a perfectly legal system that they've got, but it's a flawed system that they have. And so having the number of members in the legislature or the number of members in Parliament actually reflect the number of votes that they receive from Canadians or from Ontarians gives a much more democratic representation to the legislature or to Parliament. So if the bulk of Canadians or the bulk of Ontarians, for example, are opposed to selling off the gas plants, then the bulk of the parliamentarians or the bulk of the people in the legislature will be reflecting that view, and this sort of legislation wouldn't get passed in a proportional system.
And I totally agree with that. Now, now the other question I did have was the Senate, for example. In your personal opinion, should the Senate be abolished?
My personal opinion is no. I think that the Senate provides a strong means of modifying legislation that has been passed by the House and essentially does have a veto power. I don't think the Senate exercises the veto power very frequently, but they frequently send legislation back for revision to more accurately reflect what they think that the legislation was designed to implement. So this is what they call the sober second thought. Now, in our current system, where we have a disproportional parliament, you know, we have far more members from one party than were actually voted for, this is a really important thing that needs to exist so that the 39% of the voters that elected, say, the Liberals, who can now pass through any legislation that they choose with a majority of seats, that legislation can still be halted and turned back for revision, for modification, for updating by the Senate. So under the current system, the Senate is a really important channel to give pause to ill-considered legislation. Under a proportional system, that's probably going to be less necessary. But I still think that the Senate provides a valuable service. And I would hate to see that the Senate abolished simply because of a few people that have got high profile attention in the news in the last few years for improprieties. The bulk of the Senate is not like that, and the bulk of the Senate is doing good work in reviewing legislation that gets passed by the lower house.
Exactly. And I mean, I was going to put a Royal Canadian Air Force for the Senate just to show what that is about, just so that people know about it.
That's it.
Senate scandal. Let me just see here. Let's see if I can. Air Force. I'm just trying to figure out where I could find this here. I'm just going to type in. Let me just see here. Patrick Brazeau. What should I say? Royal Canadian Air Force. Or I was going to do the Harper one. Just one second. I'll see if I can find it here. All right, here. I think this might be the one. The Senate Games. This is what it is. That's what it's called, the Senate Games.
Let's have a look.
I think we'll love this. I'm going to play a couple of them. I'm not sure what's going on here.
It's technology.
Just give me a couple seconds here. Just give me 2 seconds. Yeah, I've just got to see what's going on here.
It is up.
Actually, you know what?
There you go.
I think what may happen is, yeah, just... hopefully my cord isn't damaged. Maybe it's my cord. I don't know.
Yeah. Let me just quickly review some of the other events that Fairvote Waterloo Region Chapter is putting on. So we've been fortunate to have a very active member who's contacted not just the Kitchener Public Library, we're presenting at on September the 8th, but he's also contacted the Waterloo Regional Library System, so in the townships. We'll be doing presentations on September 21st at Elmira Library, September 28th, I believe, at the New Hamburg Library, and then September 29th at the Baden Library. Now, I'm not entirely sure of those dates, but they're certainly all listed at the fairvoteswrc.ca website. There's a calendar on the one side, and you can see the entire calendar of events by clicking on the link there. In addition, we've been invited to a festival at Cambridge, which I think is taking place on the 24th of September. Mm-hmm. We'll have our information booth there. An organization that I'm also involved with called KW Peace is putting on an event in October during the International Days of Peace and Nonviolence. So people interested in democracy and social justice issues can come out to that. And there will be it's called PR for PR, a party and rally for proportional representation at Carl's Air Square, Kitchener City Hall, so the square in front of City Hall, on September the 17th. That takes place from 3 o'clock to 4:30, excuse me. We'll have some speeches by local politicians. We'll have some facilitated discussion where we can make contributions, send our ideas to the Special Committee on Electoral Reform. So that should be an interesting event on the 17th of September.
Absolutely, that is... Absolutely, that is great to know. So please come out to these events if you can. I mean, I have to say that, you know, I'm probably going to have to start using a planner and stuff to plan things because the only thing is that, you know, I just realized, you know, when I was supposed to call in Anita as well,
mm-hmm.
I forgot that, you know, I was supposed to respond back to her email.
Yeah, Anita Nickerson is...
And I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, Anita Nickerson is one of the highest profile members for Fairvote Waterloo. I first met her around 2009. She served on the executive for Fairvote Waterloo and is currently working at the National Council for Fairvote Canada.
Yeah.
She's the coordinator for the various chapters and local groups. She's local to Waterloo, so yes, it would have been good to have her on board with the interview here as well. So
absolutely.
I'm sorry Anita's not here today.
Absolutely, and I just want to say I apologize that she was not able to come. I forgot to email her back letting her know about this, so that was my own fault. I truly apologize to my viewers on this. I thought at least I'd say something, because it is my own fault.
Yes.
For 100 games, Katniss Everdeen defied a
mission. Here it is.
Now she faces her toughest battle.
President Snow.
It is I, Stephen Harper.
What are you doing here?
I am now in control of the Hunger Games. This time, you'll have to defeat the dirtiest challengers ever. Your opponents are Senators Pamela Wallen, Mike Duffy, and Patrick Brazzo. Welcome to the Senate Games.
The Senate Games. They abused the system. Now they must pay the ultimate price.
Wallen! You pantsuit piranha! You overexpense the Senate for your own personal travel. Who taught you to waste taxpayers' money like that?
I did work for the CDC.
Duffy, you claimed your chief residence is PEI. Why that potato-filled province?
One reason, so I can be a model for my new toy, Mr. Duffyhead!
Razzo, you improperly claimed living costs. You have to say for yourself.
I just asked one question. Can we still claim these games as an expense?
Kick his ass.
The Senate Games, where Canadian taxpayers get their revenge. 3, 2, 1.
anyway. Winner gets invited back to the conservative party.
Forget that.
Trained for that. Nuts. I didn't get to shoot anybody.
You know, Katya, have you ever considered joining the conservatives?
The odds are not in your favor.
Ouch.
I'll take that as a no.
This time, kids, they've been suspended, but they're still annoying.
So there you have it. That was the Senate Games. You can find that on YouTube. It's called Roaring Air Force New Year's Eve Special 2013, the Senate Games. And I thought that was quite entertaining, in fact. And I have to say that the funniest one I found was Patrick Brazzo.
I'm not sure that the Senate actually works like that, but it is a very funny piece.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that. So what is it with all this comedy that they actually do on the CBC and some of it is misinformed? That's why I played that on, because some of it is very misinformed. It's funny, but it's misinformed.
I think that if somebody is well aware of, the operation of the Senate and some of the issues surrounding the Senate, then seeing it presented by the Air Force like that is exceptionally funny. Unfortunately, for people who don't understand how the Senate works or what the issues are with the Senate, they may see this and interpret it as the news rather than, satire and comedy. So the more you know about the electoral system, the funnier this is.
Okay, that makes sense. In fact, I have to say that it's like, I mean, the thing is that it seems as though that... I have to see that when it comes to stuff like this, I mean, it is nice to hear, but the only thing is that I find that it's kind of not, sometimes it's not always informed as well. Like, I mean, it kind of can be a little bit construed when it comes to that information. Now, I was going to ask as well that, do you think the Senate should be elected? Because I know that's what they have in the States.
Absolutely. I think that any democratic institution that passes legislation or... turns back legislation or evaluates that, anything that is involved with the legislative process should be an elected position. So certainly the Senate should be elected. It should be elected proportionally, based on on the number of votes that are cast. But again, there are constitutional issues there as well, where the number of senators are allocated from pools of eligible candidates within certain provinces. I'm not entirely sure, but I believe that some provinces, Saskatchewan, have actually tried to elect their members of the Senate. The way that the senators are currently appointed is that the Prime Minister makes a recommendation for appointees to the Governor General, and the Governor General actually appoints people to the Senate. So the way that this has been done at the provincial level is that an election does take place. The outcome of the election is then presented to the Prime Minister as a potential recommendation to the Governor General, who then makes the final decision. So although there's an electoral process that takes place, because it is still dependent on a single person making a recommendation and then another single person actually doing the appointment, it really isn't very democratic in the long run, because there's no guarantee that the choice made by the people during the vote is actually implemented by an appointment in the Senate. So if that were formalized, where an election would take place to elect the Senate members outside of there being an appointment from the Governor General, then yes, I think that we would have a far more effective Senate that actually does reflect the views of the people that vote for them.
Oh, absolutely, and I have to say that I totally agree with that. In fact, I also think, in my opinion, judges should be elected too.
That's not a bad choice. There is common law where judges establish legislation.
Like they do in the States.
They do. Although I said that, anything that affects legislation, the electoral process, and the making of laws in Canada should be closer to the will of the electorate, closer to the will of the voters. I haven't thought very long about the potential for elected judiciary. I don't know that in itself is necessarily a good idea. there's a lot of expertise required, just plain knowledge of the law, you know, the actual facts established by the law, as well as the interpretation of the law, where the facts up for consideration don't exactly match what the law says. So I'm not sure that an elected judiciary is as good an idea as an elected Senate or a proportionally represented legislature.
Oh, absolutely. And I know in the States, I know some people here in Canada have said they don't want judges to be elected because then they're not going to listen to the views of the people. They're going to do their own biases and stuff like that, right? That's what I know some people were a little concerned about.
That's going to happen regardless. You know, judges are human beings too. They have their own opinions. They have their own thoughts of what should be. But if they are well-versed in the actual written law, they would certainly be able to determine whether their opinion matches the law as it is written. So this is where the expertise is required. You know, somebody who's well versed in the law needs to be at the judiciary, not just anybody who gets elected off the streets. I don't think that would necessarily be a good system where anybody would be eligible for a position in the judiciary just based on getting a certain number of votes. It has to be somebody with appropriate knowledge and credentials.
It's almost like with certain jobs, like, you know, like there are certain jobs out there where they'll pretty much hire anybody. Like I know with call centers, for example, and I'm just giving an example, like with certain third-party call centers, they will pretty much hire pretty much anybody off the streets because it's not a hard job to do.
It's not a hard job to do, and the outcome of a decision made by somebody working at a call center doesn't affect the entire population of a country, doesn't affect the entire population of a province. So, you know, it's the level, the scope of the decision-making that takes place in a particular job that requires, you know, varying degrees of expertise. So, example of digging ditches, you know, if you decide to throw the dirt to the left of the ditch or throw the dirt to the right of the ditch, that doesn't have a great deal of impact on the rest of the population. But deciding whether or not, there should be legislation to force everybody to wear a seatbelt in a car. Now that affects a lot of different people, and that requires a lot more consideration. You know, what is the level of freedom that people expect? Can we coerce people into taking a specific action while they're in the privacy of their own automobile? These are issues that have basis in legislative fact, but are also highly dependent on opinion. Should this go to a vote? I don't think so. I think that there is an overwhelming good for the larger population that says that yes, if people all wear seatbelts in their cars, you know, restricting their freedom of choice, it is actually better for those people who are on the roads that might be affected by somebody wearing a seatbelt or not. So, you know,
absolutely,
the greater good.
Yeah, it's some great questions. In fact, I was talking to a transit operator one time when I was taking the Grand River Transit buses. I'm not going to mention the drivers' names, of course, and I'm not going to mention any of their descriptions or anything like that, but I will say that I was talking to a bus driver, and one time I was talking to her about whether or not, you know, when it comes to passengers, whether, like, for example, one time when it comes to getting a ticket, like when it comes to passengers, like who are over the age of 16, they are responsible for their own seatbelts. The only question I have is that now what happens if, let's say, a person over the age of 16 doesn't wear a seatbelt and they're a passenger? Should the driver be responsible for that or should they not? Like, especially when it comes to elderly people.
It's public transit, and I don't think you can expect a transit operator to take responsibility for the public at large. Transit operator is responsible for the safety that he has control over.
Yeah.
But you know, in a public setting, a bus or some other public transit vehicle, possibly not. But you know, that's a judgment call. It's not a judgment call that I'm particularly qualified to make.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was just saying that. Let's say, for example, with people in their private automobiles. That's what I was talking more about as well. Now, I know when it comes to transit operators, they can't necessarily ensure that everyone is wearing a seatbelt because on city buses, they don't have seatbelts to begin with. But what I and the driver were talking about is her personal opinion was that she thinks that people who are in their own personal automobile should pretty much have their own choice whether they want to wear a seatbelt or not.
And so now we're back to what is the greater good for the larger part of the population. Now, are people bouncing around inside cars during a collision more of a danger than people who are forcibly confined and strapped in against their will but retain control of the vehicle? What's better for the people who are on the outside of the vehicle?
See, for me, as I always wear a seatbelt. Like when I've taken cabs and taxis and stuff like that, I remembered when I was when I was living in like Windsor, Ontario, like in the city of Windsor area. I once took a taxi to go to Leamington, and I was told, please buckle up because if the Ontario Provincial Police pulls you over, we've had issues where passengers have been pulled over by police.
Yes. So the passenger in a taxi, I think the passenger is responsible for wearing the seatbelt. The driver is not.
And there have been times that I have not worn a seatbelt. I have forgotten to wear a seatbelt. So I've done that too because, I mean, you know, it's a taxi cab. You know, it's like, you know, I immediately start talking to the taxi driver and I forget to wear that seatbelt sometimes.
Yeah. I try to be diligent. I try to wear my seatbelt in all moving vehicles that supply them.
Yeah, I guess when one is so used to taking a city bus, it's hard to get back into that train of thought, especially after, for myself, I haven't driven a car in over 5 years. But yeah. I'm actually going to play a video which is called Why is Senator Jaffer Nervous About Expensing Her Trips to New York City? Now, this wasn't put on mainstream media, but this is something new that I found about a year ago almost.
This is not a comedy piece.
It's not a comedy piece. It's rebel media, so it is kind of a serious piece that this guy is saying. But you know what? But as they say, all journalists do have biases. Even I have biases. So let me just put that out. We all have biases. So not everything we say is exactly true. It's just, you know, it's our personal opinion to the situation. Right, Bob?
Yeah, personal just opinions are what talk radio is all about.
Exactly.
Well, the news out of the Senate is that a massive audit has found so many senators coloring outside the lines. Let me speak more plainly. Billing for expenses that were not legitimate. Padding things, so to speak, and some of these have been referred to the RCMP. Well, that jogged my memory, and it made me think of an exchange I had with a Liberal senator named Mobina Jaffer last year. Mobina Jaffer had attended the Senate's Board of Internal Economy. That's basically the group of senators who manage Senate funds, who set the rules for what can be spent and what can be billed and what can't be. Let me quote to you what Senator Jaffer told her panel of fellow senators last year. Okay, so I'm quoting from the transcript here. I travel a lot to New York to work on United Nations business, but I am very nervous because I'm defining what United Nations business is. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going into the building of the UN. I'm working on issues that are around resolutions of the UN. So she said this last January before the Committee of Internal Economy. You heard her key words. She said she was nervous about her expenses because although she was saying it was UN business, she actually wasn't dealing with the United Nations. She was working on issues that the UN cared about. Yeah, well, so do I every day. I talk about world affairs. Does that mean I can bill my expenses to the Canadian Parliament for her junkets to New York? This was very odd, especially the fact that she would publicly say, I'm nervous about my expenses. So I wrote her a detailed letter saying, can you tell me why you were nervous? Can you tell me what the trips were about? And I also asked questions like, was anyone else also paying for these tickets? That is, were you double dipping? Were you getting paid by someone in New York for your airfare, but then also giving the receipt to the Canadian taxpayer and profiting the difference? These were blunt questions, and I thought, let me put it to her directly to hear what she has to say. And she wrote back a 7-word reply. She said, I have paid for these trips myself. Oh, really? Oh, okay. So I wrote back, and I said, well, Senator, thank you for getting back to me, but if you paid for the trips yourself, why were you nervous about them? Why were you talking to the Senate Expense Committee, and why did you say that you had gone to the UN on government business? I just put this question to her, and she wrote back another extremely brief reply, very bizarre. She said, as I wanted clarification for certainty, I have never claimed for those expenses. Well, that just gets weirder, isn't it? Because we have her on record telling her fellow senators she claimed for trips, but she didn't know if she should do it. She's very nervous. So I wrote back again. I said, can you explain why you were nervous then. I was just trying to get her to explain. And again, a very brief message back from her. I have never claimed any expenses for these trips to New York or Washington. Isn't this weird? Because she just told the Senate committee that she had billed for those trips, and she was very nervous about it. So let me just read my reply. I say, I'm sorry to parse your language so carefully, but we're both lawyers. You keep adding a qualifier, those expenses or these trips. Can you please tell me if you have ever expensed any trips to New York or Washington? And if not, why did you say what you said at committee? May I ask you again, will you release all of your expense claims? And then a six-word reply, I have not expensed any trips. Well, she had said she did for some and then not for others, and she told the Senate she did. This is jiggery pokery. I went back to her yet again, and then she said, well, when I say any trips, it's to New York. Do you believe her? I sent her one last letter back then, and this is in January of 2014. I said, Senator Jaffer, has the RCMP contacted you at all? She wrote back one word, no. All right. Well, I wrote to her again last week, and I said, are you one of the senators who has had your expenses passed on to the RCMP? Well, this time, not a seven-word answer, not a six-word answer, not a one-word answer. No answer. Hey, Senator Jaffer, if you have anything to say, whether it's one word or a thousand, you can tell me. Or who knows? Maybe I'll have to wait for some sort of statement from the witness stand. From the Rebel.media, I'm Andrew LeBeck.
Now, this was very surprising. In fact, I was going to say that we never heard anything about Mobina Jaffer, in fact. So when it comes to like issues around the Senate that I wanted to ask about is, so what happened with her? It's kind of, I mean, it seems as though that, you know, the RCMP should have questioned her her expenses. Because I know all the conservatives all got questioned.
I'm not aware of this issue at all. As you say, Rebel picked up on it, Rebel Media picked up on it, but it certainly wasn't in the mainstream press.
Yeah.
So, sadly, this issue avoided me, and this is the first I've actually heard of it. If there was an indication that improprieties were made, then yes, perhaps the RCMP should investigate. But I think there needs to be a complaint process. Somebody needs to complain to the RCMP to say, you know, this needs investigation. And until the RCMP have some reasonable cause for making an investigation, I don't think they'll be wasting their resources on something, especially when Ms. Jaffer has been so eloquent in saying that she was not expensing any of her trips.
Because I find that really, really bizarre, because it seems like the media, like CBC and a lot of these medias, and I mean, I could go on with a bunch of names, like on Royal Canadian Air Force, like, you know how when they made a show that I'm not going to mention any names, and then they do on their comedy show. So in this case here, when it comes to CBC and CTV and all these other media sources, it seems as though that, you know, there is definitely biases that they actually play. Like, you know, there is definite biases that they say, okay, let's go after the conservative senators, but what about the liberal senators? I mean, you know, there's always things in the government. I mean, regardless of their political party or their political stripe, there's always things that, you know, can always be questioned.
I have no basis to claim a fact on this, but I tend to think that the mainstream media tends to not bite the hand that feeds it. So if you're looking to attack the current sitting government, especially the sitting government that controls purse strings to possibly subsidies for media or subsidies for large corporations, no media, no organization that's the recipient of those subsidies is going to offend the government that provides those subsidies. Sadly, it means that there is no independent media in that particular case, unless you have something that is completely unfunded by the government, such as Rebel Media, which can afford to do those things because they have nothing to lose in reporting on these issues.
Or Sound FM.
Sound FM is certainly an independent media in that regard, and you can happily talk about any improprieties without causing a loss of funding from the government.
Exactly, and the funny thing is that the only thing that I've been told here at Sound FM that I'm not supposed to do is I'm not supposed to, let's say, swear before 9 p.m. I am not supposed to, for example, say anything that could be hatred to someone's race or someone's culture or anything like that. Like, we still have some rules, but it's just, I guess it's more free to speak about most of the other things, as long as it's not offending anybody.
These would be rules that's apply to everybody. You know, if I were to stand on the speaker's corner in downtown Kitchener and make hateful comments against an identifiable minority group, that would be a hate crime. You know, no matter whether I'm working for a radio station or whether I'm doing that as an individual, those are things against the law in Canada. It doesn't just affect the radio station. This happiness thing, or the advantage of the radio station is that it's not dependent on funding. So I'm thinking specifically of the CBC. You know, the CBC is claimed to be a liberal stronghold, you know, where during the conservative government, the Stephen Harper government from 2011 to 2015, always claimed that the CBC was very much biased against the conservatives. Yet that's unlikely to have been the case, since the CBC is entirely dependent on government funding. So it's far more likely that they were not being as hard-nosed in their journalistic requirements as they would have been if they had been independently funded without any government subsidy.
Absolutely. Now, I was going to get back to some questions here about fair vote. I mean,
I'm here for electoral reform and proportional representation.
Exactly. Sorry for going off the ban handle. But I mean, it's good to talk about issues like this. Like, this is stuff that Fair Vote Canada could use as well to make sure that, you know, stuff like this is as minimal as possible, right?
Fair Vote Canada and Fair Vote Waterloo certainly thinks that. Electoral reform, proportional representation, is a foundational issue. It affects absolutely everything. So where you have things like subsidies to media organizations, if there had been a proportionally represented government in place, many Canadians, I believe a majority of the Canadians, are in favor of funding the CBC. So you would not see the massive cuts to the CBC if the bulk of the legislature, of the federal government, is actually elected by people who want to have funding for the CBC. So media funding, CBC funding, many other issues, anti-poverty issues, environment issues, immigration issues, refugee issues, all those things are better when there's a proportional government in place. So proportionality, electoral reform, is that foundational issue that affects every single item that goes through the House of Commons and gets enacted on by Parliament.
Absolutely. Like, there's a book here that I have here, which is called Losing Our Voice, Radio Canada Under Search, by Alan Saulnier. And this is what he says, and this is on the front of his cover. He writes, a public broadcaster must at all times maintain an arm's length relationship to the government if it's not to become a state broadcaster. This is the story of Saulnier's battle to maintain this integrity and the danger that the battle may now be lost, thus killing public broadcasting in Canada. And this quote is from Robert Rabanovich, President and CEO of Canadian Broadcasting Corporation from 1999 to 2007.
There's a profound difference between a state broadcaster, a broadcaster that's owned by the state, owned by the government, a mouthpiece for the government, and a federally funded broadcaster. So I would really hope that the CBC is well funded federally, but still has that independent voice, where it's not just a mouthpiece, a puppet for the existing government. One of the things that happened under the first past the post system is that when the government does change from one majority government to another majority government, as we saw in the 2015 election, where we went from a majority number of seats for the Conservatives to a majority number of seats for the Liberals, policies change. And so if the CBC had truly been a state broadcaster, the message that the CBC presents to the public would change as the government changes. And that doesn't really seem to be the case with the CBC. They're just chronically underfunded. But that funding is, I think, largely independent of the viewpoint that the CBC offers.
That's great to know. Now, I wanted to ask you about the different types of proportional representation systems, like STV, MMP, alternative vote. Like, I was looking at it on the website here. Now I may have to open up another web browser here, because my web browser just froze on me. So
these are the weeds. We often talk about electoral reform discussions descending into the weeds, and so the weeds are the actual mechanics, the mechanisms that the different electoral reform systems, how they operate, how the votes are counted, what the outcome is, where the members are assigned, what the sort of local representation is. In short, electoral systems can really be summarized into two systems: proportional systems, where legislatures, parliaments represent the number of votes that are cast, based on party representation, possibly geographic representation, and majoritarian systems, where the systems are essentially a winner-take-all. First past the post, as we commonly call it, it's really a single-member plurality, is a system where only votes that are cast for the winner really have a voice in Parliament. So take Kitchener, for example. Kitchener had four or five candidates in the last federal election. Yet, only one of those members, Raj Saini, was elected to be the representative for all of Kitchener. Which really means that anybody who had voices or concerns or philosophies, ideas that were not part of the Liberal platform, so that includes the NDPs, the Greens, and most certainly the Conservatives, they have no representation in Kitchener at all. Now, Raj Saini is certainly doing a good job of trying to represent everybody, but he's not going to be able to represent a view that is contrary to what the Liberal caucus, what the Liberals have on their party platform. So this is where we get the majoritarian system. Raj Saini won with about 45% of the vote, which actually means that about 55% of the voters in Kitchener voted against Raj Saini. So the majority did not want liberal representation in Kitchener Centre, yet somebody who only received a minority of the votes, but still a plurality, got more votes than anybody else, is who's representing that. So we lose the spectrum of ideas that we would have in a proportional system. A proportional system would probably have a multi-member riding. So instead of having just a single representative for a small geographic area, you would have multiple representatives in a slightly larger geographic area. And Waterloo Region is an excellent example of that. We've got five federal ridings, five different electoral districts in Waterloo Region at the moment. There's Kitchener Centre, and then there's Waterloo, the new riding, Kitchener South Heskler, Cambridge, and then the outlying townships and a portion of Kitchener called Kitchener-Conestoga. So we have five ridings there. In each riding, currently, a single election takes place that elects a single member. And in all five ridings, the member who was elected to Parliament was elected with a minority of the votes. Still a plurality, still more votes than the next highest candidate that ran in the election, but certainly not a majority. So overall in the region, there were more people that voted against the people that are representing them than voted for them. If the entire region had become one 5-member district, and we were allowed to vote for up to 5 members on an election ballot, then the proportion of those members would probably shift. In fact, we have 4 Liberal members right now and 1 Conservative member, and except for the Liberals, every other party that was running in that election is underrepresented, including the Conservatives. The Conservatives got about 38% of all the votes in Waterloo Region. That's close to 40%. That's close to 2/5. The Conservatives really deserve 2 seats in all of Waterloo Region. And the NDP got about 18% of the votes, which is also pretty close to 20%. So they certainly deserve 1 seat in the region as well. So that would actually give a much wider spectrum, a much greater number of voices for the area. Right now we have an overwhelmingly Liberal voice in the area and 1 lone Conservative voice for the outlying rural districts. Had people been elected proportionally, we would have seen two Liberal candidates elected, two Conservative candidates elected, and one NDP candidate election. So now we have five members over an entire region, and we still have that local regional representation. It's not as though we're having to deal with issues in say, the Maritime Provinces or the Far North territories. We're still dealing with local Waterloo Region issues, and we now have our selection of any one of the five members and a spectrum of three different parties to go to, and each of those members represents citizens in all of Waterloo Region. One way of achieving that is to have something called single transferable vote, where we have a larger ballot where we can elect multiple members, and it's a ranked ballot. And let me get to explain what ranked ballots are not.
Oh, go for it.
In just a few minutes. So you would rank people on that ballot based on their preference. So you might rank Raj Saini as being a very good representative for you at the top position, but you might really want to have an NDP member, so you might rank an NDP member in the second position, and so on until you've either exhausted the ballot, or maybe there's a limit in the number of votes that you can cast, you know, from one to five, because you're only electing five representatives. Then, based on the numbers of those rankings, members would be elected to Parliament in proportion to the votes that are cast. A different way of doing it, to provide even more local representation, is to divide up Kitchener, or to divide up Waterloo Region into, say, three separate areas, three locally geographic districts. So for ease of saying this, I'm going to say Waterloo, Kitchener, and Cambridge, and then combining that with some of the outlying townships like North Dumfries and Woolwich Township, Wellesley, and Wilmot. But if we have three regional districts, you would elect a local member in each of those three electoral districts who only represent that one district. But that leaves two additional members that are not assigned to any one of those electoral districts but are assigned to the entire region. That particular system is called mixed member proportional. Mixed because we still have very local representation for a single electoral district, but it's also proportional. So if those three members are elected and their representation in that area is not proportional for all of Waterloo Region, then the top-up members, who are also voted for in the MMP ballot, are selected to ensure that there's a degree of proportionality in Waterloo Region as a whole. So the legislature, the Parliament, the House of Commons, will be composed of members who are either hyper-local, sitting in a specific electoral district, and also top-up members who represent a larger region within that district. Everybody is elected, all the members are still equal, they all still represent constituents, but now we have a degree of proportionality in Parliament. That's one way of achieving proportionality without giving up the hyper-local regional representation.
And I think that is it. Those are some great ideas. I was just pulling up the Appendix 11, Made in Canada STV, and yeah. I was reading, and I found a little bit of the history of that one. Mm-hmm. And that one here.
Is this from the 2004 recommendation for the legislative?
It's on the Fair Vote website. Okay. No, it's this one here.
Okay. Yes.
So I'm not sure.
Fair Vote Canada website.
Yes, it's on the Fair Vote Canada website. And it says here, and I was just going to give a little bit of education just for the public to know. It says STV was first used to elect city councillors in Calgary in 1916 and remained in use until 1974.
Yeah. So that's a municipal election.
And it says here as well that in 1917, the BC legislators allowed cities to adopt STV, and several cities there used the system in the late 1910s and through the 1920s, including Vancouver, South Vancouver, Victoria Nelson, Port Coquitlam. I can't say the city name.
Yeah.
Thank
Port,
you.
Port Coquitlam.
Mission City, New Westminster and West Vancouver, Lethbridge, Edmonton, Regina, Moose Jaw, Saskatoon, North Battleford, Winnipeg, Transcona, St. James, and St. Vital was also used for STV at the time, with the Manitoba cities continuing to use it until 1971. Ottawa City Council tried to introduce STV in 1916, but were blocked from the Ontario legislature in doing so.
Yeah.
So I have to say, it seems as though Ontario and I have to say it seems as though some of the eastern provinces, like when it comes to their municipal elections, it seems like theirs is just a simple system. Not a simple system, but a system that doesn't have proportional representation.
We actually have something like that in Kitchener as well. We elect multiple councillors to represent the same district in the regional council elections for Kitchener. So I think we have
that too.
We have more than two regional councillors in Kitchener, and we also have more than two regional councillors in Waterloo. Now, those are elected with a multi-member plurality system, so there's no guarantee of those members being elected proportionally. And anyway, we don't have party representation in municipal politics. But there's still a spectrum of ideas that that get represented proportionally. You know, those people in favor of LRT, those people opposed to LRTs, and those views should also be proportionally represented. But the way that those councillors are currently elected is not a proportional system. There's no guarantee of proportionality in the views expressed by the councillors elected under a multi-member plurality system, as we do with councillors. But Canada has a rich history of different electoral systems. You've just pointed out a number of different municipalities that have experimented with proportional systems, but there's been proportionality at various provincial jurisdictions as well. Case, for example, where I think it was Saskatchewan had a mixed member system for rural ridings and an STB system in urban ridings. And in fact, something similar is being proposed now by a group of people from Fair Vote Canada and Jean-Pierre Kingsley, the former director of Elections Canada.
Oh, that's good to know. I know Sarnia City Council, they actually have 8 city councillors that are, well, actually they have 4 city councillors, 4 city county councillors that are part of the city. Now, how they vote, it's quite interesting because they will allow people to vote 4 of their choice.
Yes.
For the city council, for the city council, just for city of Sarnia. Then they have 4 that people can choose, that city and county, which is both.
Okay.
And then they have a mayor that they can vote
so
for.
This sounds like a multi-member plurality system, because there's, again, if they're just voting for these number of councillors in bulk, without there's no guarantee that different viewpoints are represented proportionally. So if there's a pool of candidates running for those 4 council positions, there's going to be a wide range of views represented by those councillors. And depending on the number of people voting, you know, the viewpoints of those people voting, you would expect that you know, pro-agriculture people and anti-agriculture people, if there is such a thing, are going to be equally or proportionally represented in the slate of councillors that are elected. But by using a plurality system for electing multiple members, there's no guarantee that spectrum of views is going to actually get represented. So there's ways of dealing with that, and this is where ballots that are slightly more complex than just a single X come into play. This is where we have ranked ballots. And a ranked ballot is just a tool to elect people in an electoral system. A ranked ballot by itself is not an electoral system, although I very, very frequently hear all manner of people who should know better refer to an electoral system as the ranked ballot system, and what they really mean is another plurality system that's simply elected with ranked ballot. So a ranked ballot lets you mark on the ballot your preferred selections from 1 to 5 or possibly from 1 to 20, and then the ballots get counted. In an STV system, every vote counts in an STV system, where if there is a surplus of votes for one candidate, you know, if you have 5 members running in a, or you have members running in a 5 member district, such as in Waterloo Region, each member would need 20% of the vote in order to get a seat.
Mm-hmm.
So if one member were to get 25% of the votes, that surplus 5% vote isn't wasted. Those surplus 5% votes would actually go to the people's second choice on those ballots. So every vote counts, and every vote counts regardless of whether a threshold has been reached like that. In first past the post, where we have a single X, if somebody wins with a plurality of 40%, you know, we have 40% of the votes, which is, you know, more than the next guy who got 35% of the vote, and that actually happened in a couple of the ridings in the last federal election. There's an extra 5% of the vote. You know, the plurality here is 5% more than the next guy. So 35% for the second place guy, 40% for the first place guy. That extra 5% does not give any more representation in Parliament. And by the same token, all those people who cast their vote for the second place candidate, 35%, none of those votes actually went towards electing anybody to represent them in Parliament. Now, this is what Fair Vote Canada calls wasted votes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's the argument to be made that any vote cast in an election is not a wasted vote. All votes are certainly counted, but all votes aren't counted, don't have equal representation.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, and the one thing is that I was looking at a map here when it came to STV and STV Plus.
Yes.
And it shows here, like figure four, like central Toronto, right, for example, has 12 federal seats in Parliament. One of them, the most urbanized regions in the country. If we had concluded that the 2015 election under STV, then they might considering grouping all 12 ridings into a single electoral district. But this would be a larger district than Canada's ever used.
Yeah.
Alternatively, this might have considered various combination, two districts of 6 seats, one of 8, and one of 4, or perhaps three four seat districts.
Yeah.
Using 3-4 seat local districts, for example, one district might cover south central Toronto, one of the western portion of the city, and the third for the eastern portion. So what it's showing here is that, okay, you have 50% of voters represented right now with the first past the post, and this is on the website.
Yes.
And the STV would be 96%. So STV is actually much better because you have more people represented.
Exactly. You have a wider spectrum of people represented, and you have far more votes that actually go to elect somebody in Parliament. Under an STV system, even if your first choice candidate doesn't get elected, your second choice candidate still gets a portion of those votes and may actually be elected based on that thing, on that ranking of the votes. A ranked ballot doesn't guarantee proportionality, though, because there's another system called alternative vote or preferential ballot or instant runoff voting, where there's a ranked ballot that takes place, but votes for the lowest ranked party, or lowest ranked candidate rather, are completely discarded and don't count towards electing any more representation. So you end up electing a single member with a ranked ballot, which is really no better than electing a single member with a plurality system like first past the post. It's still a majoritarian system. You're electing a single member in a single riding, but you're using a ranked ballot to do it. So it doesn't get you any proportionality, and in fact it makes it worse, because invariably candidates for the smaller parties tend to be rejected early on in the voting process and really have no ability to gain a seat under that system.
And that's the STV?
That's what's commonly called alternative vote or preferential ballot or instant runoff voting. And The three names all refer to the same system, which ensures that the candidate that wins gets 50% or more of the votes,
mm-hmm.
but not all of those votes are number one votes. Many of the votes get discarded, and many of the votes don't go towards getting more representation in Parliament. So the whole idea behind having a proportional system is that almost every vote goes towards electing a member to the legislature, whether that's a member who's in the majority of the legislature or a minority member, or even one of the smaller parties. For example, across Canada, we had about 300,000 people casting a vote for the Libertarian Party. Now, each riding in Canada is about 100,000 people in size, you know, from 90,000 to maybe 110,000. But typically a riding in Canada is about 100,000 people, represents about 100,000 people. If there's 300,000 votes cast, that's the equivalent of three ridings. The Libertarians should probably have 3 seats in the legislature. Now, 100,000 or 300,000 votes is barely 1% of the electorate, and many people advocate to have a threshold of, you know, 5, 10, 15% of the votes needed before they can get any representation in Parliament. I think that's grossly unfair, because if you have a group of people spread across the entire country with enough votes to be the equivalent of a single electoral district, you know, 100,000 votes or more, or 100,000 people represented or more, that should certainly result in some representation in Parliament. Yes, it's going to be a very much a minority view. Yes, it's going to be a fringe view, but a single seat in Parliament isn't going to sway Canada's policies towards, you know, wildly radical ideas. You're not going to get some of the more extreme ideas represented in Parliament from a single seat in the legislature that's proposing something like that. It's unlikely that radical ideas would ever be asked to participate in coalitions, would ever be able to carry enough sway in Parliament in general to carry those radical views to forming legislation. So the idea that fringe parties are dangerous in the proportional system is really unfounded completely. There's no basis, in fact, and you can look at other countries that have proportional systems where there are fringe parties that are elected. Those countries are certainly not considered radical or extreme based on a single member in their legislatures having radical or extreme ideas.
Okay, absolutely. And I mean, I have to say that when it comes to, for example, I'm reading the MMP, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading MMP, and I know I tend to jump from one place to another. I pretty much should have a script on this, and I apologize. Sometimes, you know, I call myself a scatterbrain. I tend to be everywhere sometimes. But I mean, I am looking at this here as we speak. And one thing I'm reading is about the MMP on this, right?
Yes.
The Made in Canada.
Mixed member proportional system, yes.
Yeah. And it says here that with the mixed member proportional system should be based on giving two votes, one for constituency and one for party.
Yes.
And I like this system too as well. So these are the top two systems. First one I would choose is STV Plus or STV.
Not entirely sure what STV Plus is, but certainly the mixed member proportional gives you a very powerful ballot. Your ballot is split into two parts. So you elect a local representative. And this is what I explained before, you know, Waterloo could be divided into three local electoral districts, Cambridge, Waterloo, and Kitchener, perhaps.
Yeah.
And then there would be top-up members, two additional top-up members that get chosen from the second half of the ballot, where perhaps only the parties are listed, and then members are chosen based on a list prepared by the parties ahead of time. That's called a closed-list system, and is exceptionally unpopular in Canada, and certainly in Ontario. Another way of doing it is to list all the candidates that are running in a particular district and have people either rank those candidates or just select the candidate they want based on their party affiliation on the second half of the ballot. So the first half of the ballot looks exactly like the ballot looks today. You know, you put an X for your preferred candidate for your local electoral district representative. And then the second half of the ballot is either just a list of the parties for the closed list system, or it's a list of all the candidates that are running in that riding. And based on the number of votes gained by those candidates, the top-up members are elected. So all members are elected, whether they're top-up members or electoral district candidates. So that second system where all the candidates are listed is called an open-list system.
Mm-hmm.
There's a third way called a no-list system, where you really only have a single ballot that represents the candidates that are running in the election overall. And based on the party affiliation, you don't have a closed list that the parties come up with ahead of time, but the second half of the ballot simply chooses party affiliation. And based on the number of votes that were cast on the first half of the ballot, candidates that were not given a position in office are elected from, you know, the leftover candidates to represent the region as a whole. So that's called a no-list system, and there's a few jurisdictions in Germany that use a no-list system. It's not particularly popular. The open-list system is by far more popular. To give it a little bit of perspective, Canada, who's a big admirer of New Zealand uses a closed-list system. And although closed lists aren't well-liked by Canadians, what tends to happen is that a party that puts up a list of candidates that will be elected on the closed list system that don't meet the electorate's approval,
mm-hmm.
if you don't like the list of candidates, you're not going to go vote for that party. So parties are going to be very careful to give a good representation on their closed list if they do in fact have a closed list system. That said, I would much prefer to see an open list system in an MMP.
Me too. Actually, I was just reading a little bit about that, the open list system, and it says here that this was recommended by the Jenkins Commission in the UK.
Yes.
The colorful explanation accurately predicted why closed lists would be rejected in Canada, as they put it, additional members locally anchored are. And it continues on by saying when Sweden changed from a closed list to a flexible list, some women feared male backlash would result in women being moved down to the moving down the list, like they would go down the list.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, more women were moved up than down.
Because it attracts a wider range of voters. You know, the parties are pretty clever. You know, they do a lot of polling. They understand what the electorate wants, and they will adjust their closed list or even their open or their lists to make sure that the voters' will is reflected in the list that they propose, because they'll get more votes that way.
Exactly, and I think the one thing is that when they actually do pollings, and you know when political parties and MPs and MPPs say we don't pay attention to polls, that's just a lie.
I think that a lot of the polls are actually commissioned by the parties themselves in order to gauge what the electorate wants. They can base their policies and platforms on what the electorate wants. They want to get elected. So the best way to get elected is to get elected on an issue that, you know, people are in favor of. There's one way of legislating a certain demographic. So, for example, if you want gender balance in your parliament, an easy way to do that with a closed list is to mandate that the list have alternating genders on their list. So you might have the party leader, Elizabeth May, at the top of the list, but then the second member on that list has to be male, because you have to alternate male. So the third member on that list would have to be female, and the fourth member would have to be male again. And so you have what's called a zipper list, you know, alternating genders, in order to ensure that you have equal gender representation in Parliament when the votes are all counted. So that requires a closed list, because you need to know ahead of time how you're going to rank those candidates or rank the members on those lists. That said, I'm still not in favor of a closed list, even if you can legislate religious diversity or ethnic diversity or gender diversity based on legislating the composition of such a list.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the one thing is that when it comes to stuff like this, I mean, I have to say that, you know, even though I may not have much knowledge about this, I will say that we do need a change in the electoral system. See, the funny thing is this. When I lived in Sarnia, Windsor, in London, and Kitchener, I didn't hear a lot of, like, the fair vote people going out to a lot of events. I know here in Kitchener, they're out all over, and that's amazing. I like that, actually.
Yeah. Waterloo region is a hotbed for electoral reform activity. We have a very active chapter, probably one of the most active chapters in all of Canada. I know there's a Toronto, no longer a chapter, but still an active group. So they're very active in Toronto, but that's also where Fair Vote Canada is based. You know, they have their head office in Toronto. And there's active chapters in other electoral hotbeds, Vancouver, Yukon actually has, Whitehorse has a strong chapter as well.
I think you know what? I think what we need is we need to make all these great, amazing chapters, because this work is so amazing. Make all the districts all in Canada. We all ramp up and we all work together, and then we get the message across all across Canada. Because the only thing is that, you know, if people in the region of Waterloo are getting the message, but let's say people in Windsor, London, Sarnia, Toronto, and other places may not be as aware of it, it may be more helpful to get everyone on board at the same rate as what our chapter is. Certainly, or the chapter of this district, yeah. I should say.
Like I said earlier, proportional representation is a foundational issue. And there are certain areas, geographic areas in Canada. Now, Canada is really, really big. So
yeah.
In the Northwest Territories, Nunavut, Yukon, there's a huge geographic area that's represented by only three members of parliament in those areas. So proportional representation is going to be very difficult to achieve in those areas, because there aren't enough members of parliament to achieve any kind of proportionality. There's only three members for, you know, half the geographic area of Canada. You can't get much proportionality out of three members. One of the oddities is that the larger your electoral district with multiple members, the larger that area is, and the more members that you include in your multi-member district, the more proportional your parliament becomes. So taking that to its extreme, taking all of Canada as a single electoral district and having to elect, you know, 338 members on a huge long ballot would give you complete proportionality, but it would completely ruin any sort of geographic representation. You'd be mixing up the urban population with the agricultural, the rural population. You'd be mixing up the northern population with the southern population. You'd be mixing up the east coast with the west coast. It is not a system that's going to go over well in Canada. One of the common complaints that I hear is that proportional representation leads to unstable systems. And the examples that are always trotted out are Italy and Israel. Italy and Israel have completely different electoral systems than anything that's ever been proposed in Canada. Israel, for example, all of Israel is a single electoral district that I just described. But that sort of thing just would not fly in Canada and is never going to be proposed in Canada. Oddly enough, the Netherlands has exactly the same sort of electoral system that Israel does. But you never hear about instability and bad outcomes from the electoral system in the Netherlands. It's always Italy or Israel that's being used as the bad example. Yet there are an equal number of good examples for that sort of system. And, as I say, that sort of system, a block vote, a large, complete country electoral district, is never going to be proposed in Canada. In part because there's a constitutional requirement to have a certain number of representatives based on provincial allocations. So you'll never see that happen in Canada. Using Italy and Israel as bad examples of proportional representation is, as Dennis Pilon, a professor at at York University and an expert in electoral reform, as he says, if you're going to be using Israel and Italy as bad examples of proportional representation, you should be using Zimbabwe as an example of a good implementation of first past the post. Zimbabwe is not known for having a good electoral system, and they use first past the post, so you have good examples and bad examples for first past the post, as you have good examples and bad examples for proportional representation.
Now, what about like countries like China, where it's all dictatorship?
Oh, there's no proportionality there. You don't have a chance to vote for your dictator. Although in some countries, and I'm not entirely sure which ones they are, there are elections held with a single candidate on the ballot. I'm not really sure what that achieves, but that's not a democracy.
That is not, definitely.
And when we look at proportional representation worldwide, we really only look at countries that are similar to Canada. So that would be the top countries in the OECD, the top countries in the Human Development Index, countries that are similar to Canada, preferably similar geographically, where you have a wide range of geographic features, coastal areas and northern areas and urban areas and rural areas. Difficult to do that because Canada is somewhat unique in that, very large with a small population and just very geography from coast to coast to coast.
See, I was reading here where it says, for instance, polls show that 90% of Canadian voters want to see more women elected.
Yes.
Which, I mean, that does say that on your website. It says, if they can choose from several of their party regional candidates, they'll almost certainly elect more women. Now, here's my question here is that who did that poll?
That's come out in multiple polls. It's actually been demonstrated in countries where they do have proportional representation. They tend to have a higher number, they tend to have better gender balance in their parliaments, in their legislature, when those members are elected proportionally. And largely that's because if in any one particular district, the preferred candidate is an old white man, then if you repeat that across 338 separate elections in Canada, you're going to elect 338 old white men to the legislature.
Exactly.
Even though, the second choice everywhere might be a young woman of color. So if there was proportionality, then the old white men would be elected in proportion to the number of people that vote for them, not just based on a plurality, a winner-take-all system in multiple different districts. You're going to get a proportional outcome. So you'll get old white men elected in proportion to the number of votes that they get. You'll get young women of color elected in proportion to the number of votes that they get. So proportionality isn't just for party affiliation. Proportionality extends across gender diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, and certainly political diversity as well.
And I think that's a great thing. In fact, but the only question I have here is that I recently watched a statement that Jane Elliott said, and what Jane Elliott said here was that there's no four or five different races on the face of the planet. There's only one race on the face of the planet, and that is the human race.
Exactly.
And I mean, and the one thing is, I know she's trying to get that out here, and she's saying a lot of the racism and all the other discrimination and stuff that we learn about, this is stuff that we've been taught in our school system.
That could be. There's frequently here in the news about young white black men who are disproportionately incarcerated, they're disproportionately stalked by the police. Who do they have to advocate for them in our political system right now? Do young black men get elected to parliament, or they get elected to the provincial legislature in proportion to their population? No, not really. So having a proportional representation system in the voting system is going to increase that sort of diversity as well. It isn't just the political spectrum. Now, there's no guarantee that this will happen, but evidence based on other jurisdictions where they do have proportional representation shows that there's better gender balance, there's probably better cultural balance, better ethnic balance in their legislatures. There's another issue that's commonly brought up is voter turnout. Voter turnout has been declining year after year after year, to getting just over 50% of voter turnout in the 2011 election. There's happily a very large bump to over 60% voter turnout in the 2015 election. It turns out that when your vote counts, when every vote that gets cast goes to contributing towards representation in parliament, more people go out to vote because they think that their vote will actually count for something, because it does under a proportional system. So again, there's no guarantee that you'll get increased voter turnout under a proportional system, but the evidence tends to show that after a proportional system is introduced, you get a bump of 7 to 10% increase in voter turnout. Now, after a while, that declines again, but you tend to have larger voter turnout by 3, 4, 5% in jurisdictions that have proportional representation compared to those that have majoritarian systems.
Exactly, and see, there's this one guy, his name is Matthew, I think his name is Matt Green, I should say, and he's a Hamilton City Councilor, and he was saying about how he wants racial profiling completely stopped.
Yes.
And I know he was saying that how when he was living in Hamilton, he would be waiting for the bus, and he would be racially profiled, even as a councilor.
Just recently, just in the last month or two, he was stopped by a police officer, for waiting at the bus stop while black. Matt Green is a black councilor. I didn't know this. I follow Joey Coleman. He's a crowdsourced reporter in Hamilton, and reports on issues like this. And he's been forwarding information that Matthew Green posts on Twitter and other online sources. So I was vaguely aware that Matthew Green existed. I had no idea that he was a black man on Hamilton City Council. And so when I heard about this, it just goes to show that people who are in a minority position need representation in their legislative bodies, whether it's on municipal council or in the federal parliament. People need representation because there are issues that are unique to young black men or old white men, even for that matter, that need to be represented in parliament.
And I agree. But I mean, the only question I've had as well is now I have heard that some people have mentioned to me that let's say we how workplaces, for example, they're pushing towards hiring more minorities and more people, right? But here's the other question that I've had been asked by other people as well is, now what about the family, let's say you have the family-owned businesses that are, let's say you have the Asian person that owns a convenience store, for example, right?
Yeah.
Now, what about if, let's say, someone of that non-ethnicity goes and applies to that position, applies for a job, they're not going to get it. Now, don't you think that that is also discrimination too? Because, discrimination is discrimination, but
absolutely.
At the same time...
Absolutely. And this is a provincial jurisdiction, provincial labor law. There are already laws on the books that prevent hiring based on race or, gender issues. These things are already protected.
They are, exactly.
Legislation. Sadly, there's no legislation that protects candidates running in an election, from having proper, having equal representation. So implementing a proportional representation system for elections goes some way towards ensuring that you have no racial discrimination, no ethnic discrimination, no cultural discrimination.
And I agree with that,
So proportional representation is a foundational issue.
It's a good one.
It addresses many issues across the spectrum, you know, from economic issues to racial issues.
Now, what about when it comes to, let's say, making sure that, because I think this is a great system. Now, what about discipline? Like, let's say, not necessarily party discipline, but member discipline to make sure that, you know, we can try to minimize any sort of discrimination or anything like that. Because, I mean, the main thing that I want to make sure is that, okay, yes, let's go with a proportional representation. Let's make sure everybody's equally represented. But my question is that now what happens if people are still discriminated based on their race or their ethnic, like their gender or something like that? How is that going to be addressed in the new system?
I don't think it needs to be addressed specifically. Once a proportional means of counting ballots is in place and members are elected to the federal parliament based on those proportionalities, we'll see better representation from all segments. You know, better gender representation, better ethnic representation, better racial representation, better representation of diverse political views. Within the parties themselves, there is still the issue of party discipline. And sadly in Canada, Canada's parliamentary system has a history of whipped votes, where there's one parliamentarian who's assigned to ensure that all members of the caucus vote according to party lines. Many cases, votes in the legislature are free votes, where the party whip does not enforce a particular policy to take place, or for members to vote according to party lines on a particular policy. What that does, what the whipped vote does, is it moves the representation from the people to the representative. So no longer is the representative for the party representing the people in his constituency. Instead, what ends up happening is that that member of parliament is representing the party's policies and views to the people. So the whole direction of representation gets reversed with a whipped vote. There are some parties that are more that issue whipped votes more frequently than other parties. So, surprisingly, the Conservative Party has maybe 30-40% of their votes whipped. So, members of the Conservative Party have to vote according to party line in about 30-40% of the votes that are cast in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
The NDP actually whips far more votes in the legislature than the Conservatives do. So, having a Conservative member in your riding actually gives you a better chance of having your views properly represented in Parliament than having an NDP candidate. An odd outcome to what you would think might just be the other way around. The Green Party, I'm a Green Party member, you know, upfront knowledge there. I'm a member of the Green Party and I ran as a Green Party member in the last federal election. Green Party does not enforce whipping at all. Every member is required to represent their constituents. So when Elizabeth May represents the constituents of Saanich Gulf Islands, if those members of her constituency have a particular view that they want represented to Parliament, then Elizabeth May is required to present those views to Parliament, whether or not it aligns with her own personal philosophy or even whether it aligns with the Green Party policy. Her job is to represent her constituents to Parliament, which is really what every member of parliament should be required to do. But
I agree.
Whipped votes get in the way of that, and reverse that thing to having the member of parliament represent the party to the constituents and not the other way around.
And I agree with that, because I know with the fact that, you know what, like for me is, when it comes to the Green Party, I'm a Green Party supporter, and I'm going to be honest with you, it's because they don't whip their votes. This is why I like the Green Party a lot more than all these other parties. But to be truthful is, now there's a whole lot of backlash that Elizabeth May is getting from her delegates. Now, what's going on with that?
Okay, so a little diversion there. Let me wear my green hat for a few minutes. There was a Green Party National Convention a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Many resolutions were brought to the convention to be voted on, you know, to be passed as policy for the Green Party. The one that springs to mind is, should the Green Party support a tax on sugary beverages? You know, that resolution was brought to the convention and overwhelmingly passed. You know, almost every Green member in attendance there was in favor of passing a tax on sugary beverages. Many other resolutions were passed there too, but the two that stand out are the resolution Should the Green Party support the BDS movement, the boycott, the divest and sanction movement to protect the Palestinians in occupied territories in Israel? It's a means of ensuring that human rights continue to be upheld in the Palestinian territories there. It did not meet with universal approval for the Green Party. There were some people that voted against that. Amongst those people was Elizabeth May. Now, Elizabeth May is the party leader, as she describes herself. She's a party spokesperson, doesn't want to be seen as a top-down leader. And in fact, the Green Party doesn't work like that. The Green Party mostly works on consensus. All the members of the Green Party, not just the candidates, but anybody who's a member of the Green Party, has an opportunity to voice their opinions at these national conventions, and resolutions and policies are based on the consensus of all the members. Sadly, at the convention that was held 2 weeks ago, that consensus idea was ripped out and replaced with Robert's Rules of Order, which is a majoritarian voting system. So if a majority of the people at that convention voted in favor of a particular resolution, that resolution would pass, even if there was a significant minority of the people who voted against that resolution. There was no consensus achieved by the Green Party members at that convention. So this is Elizabeth May's large issue there, that she felt that based on her own personal philosophy, she could not adequately represent the members of her riding and adequately be the leader of the Green Party with this particular resolution being supported by the Green Party members, and especially considering that it was not arrived at by a consensus decision. So, happily, yesterday she made an announcement at a press conference saying that she will not resign her position as party leader, and she won an overwhelming approval of for her leadership position. You know, 94% of approval rate within the party in an approval vote that was held a few months back. So most members of the Green Party are very happy that Elizabeth May will continue to be the party leader, even though she holds a view in opposition to the resolution that was passed at the Green Party. Now, that because that resolution was passed not by a consensus method, Elizabeth May announced that there would be a special meeting of the Green Party, another convention, a special meeting where these resolutions would be ratified by a consensus method. So the Green Party as a whole will come to a consensus on how they want to approach the BDS support movement at a consensus-based meeting, at a special meeting later on this year. But initially, Elizabeth May will stay on as leader. She holds a view in opposition to that, but those views will be taken into account at the special meeting later this year, probably around December, when the Electoral Reform Committee that Elizabeth May also sits on, when that has wound down some.
And I hope she doesn't resign, because tell you the truth is, you know what, that's the great thing about the Green Party is, you know what, you can have whatever view you want, even though you oppose your own party's view.
It's expected that Green Party members will, in bulk, support the Green Party policies. And because those policies are arrived at by consensus, most everybody who runs for the Green Party, the candidates, do espouse those views. But, you know, on individual issues, such as the BDS movement, such as perhaps, you know, the copyright policy, individual members may disagree with individual resolutions. But it really doesn't matter, because the job of a Green Member of Parliament is to represent his constituents or her constituents' view to Parliament, in spite of what Green Party policy may indicate, and in spite of what a member's personal views might happen to be. The job is to represent the constituents to Parliament.
And I agree with that, because the one thing is that I know for myself is, like, whenever, like, with my own radio show, I do the absolute best I can to represent everybody. Even though I may or may not agree with someone's views, I do my best to represent those views, because, you know what, that's what alternative media is. And I like the way that the Green Party works. Even though they are an alternative party, at least, you know what, it's a good party.
I like to think that they're a mainstream party. They have an elected member in Parliament, so, you know, I like to think of the Green Party as a mainstream party.
Or the mainstream party. See, I call them, see, the only reason I use the word alternative, it's because I guess the thing is that the mainstream media doesn't tend to talk a lot about it, but I think, you know what, it is a major political party, and that's a good
thing. The mainstream media certainly picked up on this one particular issue, you know, out of dozens, maybe hundreds of resolutions that were debated at the convention. They picked up on this one issue of BDS, and they picked up on the one member of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, who was in opposition to that rule. You know, so certainly the mainstream media has a knack for finding, you know, little areas of contention. They did not report on the fact that almost every other piece of resolution that was passed at that meeting went by without any controversy at all. That, you know, the bulk of the Green Party members, the bulk of the Green Party candidates for the Green Party nationally were all in favor of these things. They didn't pick up on that. They picked up on the one issue, one resolution with one member in opposition to that. Now, admittedly, that was the spokesperson for the Green Party, the Green Party leader, and that has a bit of a higher profile, but no attention is paid to the fact that, for the most part, the Green Party is a party of consensus and a party that represents the constituents, the parliament, not the other way around.
And that's how it should be. I mean, the one thing is that, you know, I think what mainstream media tries to do is they try to get their own biases up, and they try to, you know, they try to favor what they want people to hear, which I think is wrong, because I think the thing is that, you know, like with me, I personally like to talk to all party members. I wish I could have all party members here, have like all the Liberals, Conservatives, NDP, Green, everyone sitting in my radio station today, and be able to talk about the mainstream media and what happens, right? Because, I mean, people really deserve to know what happens in their own parties, right?
I'll make an excellent other show. I'm here today specifically to wear the half for Fair Vote Canada.
Yeah.
So Fair Vote Canada is a multi-partisan organization. We've got members from across the spectrum, Conservative members, NDP members, Liberal members, Green members from the Pirate Party, members who are unaffiliated with any party, members from the Marxist-Leninist Party. You know, we have members from across the entire political spectrum. Fair Vote Canada and Fair Vote Waterloo Region Chapter is certainly a multi-partisan organization.
That's awesome. That's great. I mean, that's a good thing to have as well. Now, I'm going to try to end with a couple quotes here.
Sure.
And I tried to be non-partisan here, so I picked one from the Green, NDP, and the old Liberal quotes that were on the Fair Vote website.
All right.
So we're going to start with Elizabeth May. And what Elizabeth May said was, the vast majority of modern democracies use one form or another of proportional representation that gets higher voter turnout, higher levels of women in political office, and more diverse ethnicity within parliaments. First past the post is a preserved system. It is tearing this country apart. That's a great quote. And Tom Mulcair says, in a democracy, every vote should count. It's as simple as that. But sadly, in our outdated winner-take-all electoral system, that isn't the case. It's a system that allows parties to wield majority control with a minority of votes. And as a result, the voice of many Canadians just aren't heard. It doesn't have to be this way. For decades, New Democrats have fought for fair and proportional voting system and will continue to lead the fight to modernize our electoral system so that Parliament finally reflects your will. A quote from Pierre Trudeau, it will be even more difficult for the federal government to speak in the name of the nation and form national policy unless Canada adopts a more proportional voting system. So the best quotes, I will say, is from Tom Mulcair and Elizabeth May. Those are the two best quotes that I found off of the site on that. With Pierre Trudeau, I have to say that that's a very short quote.
It's a short quote, but you know, a pithy one. I agree with all of that. You know, certainly we will see better representation. We'll see the votes count more. We'll see voter turnout increase. We'll see better gender representation in Parliament. All those things are good outcomes of proportional representation.
Well, as always there, Bob, I just want to say thank you so much for coming into 100.3 Sound FM CKMS Radio Waterloo and speaking with me today. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
It's great to be here, Aline. Thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure. So there you have it. That's Bob Jonkman. He is part of the Fair Vote Canada representation. And what is your role in that?
I'm the co-chair on the executive board for the Fair Vote Canada Waterloo Region chapter.
That is great. And in fact, it's always a pleasure to have him on here. And I just want to say thank you so much to all our listeners for listening to the Aline Show today on 100.3 Sound FM. You can definitely listen every Tuesday from 12 to 2 on 100.3 Sound FM. Or you can even go on to soundfm.ca and listen live. Or you can even tune to your Rogers cable box at channel 946. I just want to tell everyone peace out and have a great day. And I'm just going to go ahead and we'll play some music for the last 10 minutes. And then the Agriculture Show with Jeff Stagner will continue from 2 to 4. So thank you for listening and have a great day.